This is Sarah Reith with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll hear from Wendy Jackson, who is originally from Detroit, Michigan. She and her husband were both formally trained carpenters when they came to Potter Valley from San Luis Obispo County in 1979.
I had a good friend who'd moved up because his good friend wanted to investigate going back and living in the country and building his own place. So that person, who was a good friend of mine in San Luis Obispo, also a fellow apprentice in the Carpenter's Hall, got me excited about the aspect of building my own house and doing it affordably in a place that had land that wasn't as expensive as land was down in San Luis Obispo County at the time, and that was here. I thought we'd be building out in a rural place, that there wouldn't be very many great roads nearby or a lot of easy shopping nearby, so I figured that we would be living without ice cream or maybe even running water at first, or didn't know what kind of heat we would be having, and certainly didn't know anything about what kind of power we would be having, although my husband at the time was pretty interested in what was going to happen power-wise.
What did you find when you got here?
Well, when I got here, I found, of course, an already started base of friends because of my friend Bill Fassett, who had moved up here earlier and already had friends up here that were doing similar things. So I found somebody who was interested in the piece of property we eventually found but had changed his mind. After a day of looking with a realtor, we ran into him by accident sitting on a bench outside of the Potter Valley General Store. And he said, you should go take a look at the property we decided not to buy. So we proceeded to do that the very next day and thought it was great and perfect, had great water, excellent source of water at the very top of the property. So everything was gravity fed from there, no pumps or holding tanks, well, holding tank, but no pumps involved. And we proceeded to make an offer on that piece. Yeah.
So what did you do? What were the first tasks when you moved onto this property?
The very first tasks were moving our basic equipment up. So we took our 1942 Chevrolet fire engine that we had acquired down in San Luis Obispo County, and we hitched our little travel trailer to it, and we took the waterbed out of the back quarters of the travel trailer and turned it into a chicken coop so we could move our chickens up. And I drove the 1953 Bel Air up, and my husband drove the fire truck with the trailer travel trailer towed behind it up to our little place on Alder Creek off of the Eel River. So we found a piece of raw property. My husband built a water wheel out of ABS pipe and bigger ABS hubs, and used that to make his own Pelton wheel to power our living situation, which was just a trailer for a while we were thinking about where to build. And we lived by a pond for a couple of years while we were designing the house that we were going to eventually build. And we were both board carpenters with rectangular, rectilinear, single-story homes with gable roofs. And we drew all kinds of sketches, you know, two-story, one-story, L-shaped, U-shaped, you know, straight line, whatever. And then one day I just drew a spiral. And Will, my husband, said, yeah, that's it. Let's do that. And so, you know, we expanded on the drawing from just a crude spiral to the actual golden mean, the golden rectangle, which generates a nautilus shell-shaped spiral that's actually geometrically accurate. And we even took our drawings down to Mendocino College, to the math department, and said, is this correct? Are we getting this right, the golden mean, and how we generate this nautilus-shaped spiral? And he said, yeah, actually, there's a formula for this. You got it. It's a rectangle, and it's a basic ratio of the length of the rectangle to the width. And from that, you can generate this nautilus shape. So then we built a little model out of little balsa wood sticks because we really, and the model spirals not only inward, but it also raises upward. So it was a two-story sized nautilus shaped post and beam structure. So we were no longer board carpenters.
What exactly is a board carpenter? You gave a little bit of a sketch, but What is that?
A board carpenter is somebody who's been building for some time and knows, okay, yeah, you put up a wall there, you put up a wall there, and then you put the roof on. Well, of course, you start with a foundation, but, you know, you're building with 90-degree angles, you're building with flat floors. And of course, people do want flat floors, but you're building with a roof line that's either a gable or a shed or a mansard roof or something that's fairly straightforward. In this case, we were building a roof that was kind of boat-shaped because it swooped in, it curved. It curved as it went around and it curved as it went up, so it was kind of swale-shaped the whole distance. Yeah, it was fun. It was really great fun. It was a tremendous project. I mean, Will, my husband, was so inventive. He built his own little crane to lift up beams. You know, we had this little, like, bird's nest around the center of the tree because it spiraled around a tree in the middle that was actually not a live tree. That would have been too problematic. But we harvested a tree from lower on the property, set it into a big concrete anchor where the tree would belong in the building. And then Will was in this little crow's nest notching the tree trunk for these rafters as they came in and spiraled around. And I was on the outside of the building on the beams going, you know, placing the beams on the outside where the spread was wider, of course, as it went around. But, you know, the pictures are great, but the reality was really great.
Yeah. How long did it take you?
It took 2 years to do the basic structure and get it closed in. And then I guess you could say it's still happening.
So you mentioned that you brought chickens up. How did you figure out how to feed yourselves while you were homesteading?
Thank you very much. We decided that we would go to work as carpenters during the winter months. And then as soon as good weather hit in the spring, we would stop working for money and go ahead and work on our place. So that's how that went for a good 4 or 5 years until we decided to have a child. And then that mode of doing things changed somewhat. But yeah, so we would go to work and get money. For a while we were doing union carpentry stuff here in town, but then that kind of work pretty much went away. So we just went out to work on our own. Eventually these three guys on motorcycles came up our road and pulled into the front yard of the trailer and said, "We're from the Yurt Works, and we heard you were a carpenter." They said this to me, not to Will. "And we want to hire you. Come with us." Pretty much. And and I said, "I'm not coming right now, but this is kind of interesting. Tell me more." So I did go down and talk with them about the business and what the work would be like, and wound up working at the Yurt Works, which is now California Yurts, for I think about 4.5 years. Yeah. So that was some great income too. And also that was a great connection to the wider community, because the Yurt Works was started by, let's see, from people from up Pine Avenue in Potter Valley. That was one of them. David Raitt, of course, was the main force behind it. And Mark, David's great friend, and he's passed away now. And then Peter Armstrong, who was from outside Potter Valley at the time, and Ed Keller, who was from Pine Avenue. So there were 4 or 5 different partners in the crew, and that enabled me to meet a whole bunch of people. And we raised our own vegetables to an extent, you know, but we weren't massively perfect gardeners, not like some of the people I know around here. So we planted things like tomatoes and squash, and we weren't even into lettuce. We weren't that skilled and expert at it. So we would go to the grocery store to get our food, and we paid for our groceries by working as carpenters. Yeah.
What about some of the encounters with wildlife up there in the wild country?
Some of the wildest life were people. Because you could, you know, you're out in the middle of what you figure is nowhere, and one night somebody just came knocking on our little sliding glass door on the trailer out of the blue, you know, out of the dark, a white face at the door. Pretty startling. And it turns out that he knew the place from years before, when people used to gather at this little clearing that we had our trailer parked in. They would come up, hike up from the Eel River along Alder Creek, and just hang out there and build fires and sing songs or take drugs or whatever, you know. So that was really rather scary and frightening, but he was okay. It was just a little surprising. But okay, encounters with wildlife. Bears, for sure, you know, like so many other people. We had a dog and we had a cat, and we fed them both outside. So there would be times when you'd open up the back door and the bear would be right there, because the cat food was on a little shelf right by the back door, so the dog couldn't get it. We had it up high and it was right there, so we could easily fill it up. You know, we didn't want to have to walk too far, you know, that was too much effort. But so yeah, there were times when you could open the door and there was a bear, and then you just close the door and went to a window to see if the bear was going away, you know. And they're pretty, you know, they're largely harmless. We had a little sleeping platform in the summer months that we just enjoyed being outside in the fresh air and sleeping on that overnight instead of being in the little trailer. And one morning, just, you know, as you wake up and just kind of lay there while you're still not up but you're awake, a bear just came trooping right past and just kept going. You know, we both are nudging each other and didn't want to say anything, but, you know. Yeah, so those were the most exciting times. There was a fire in 87 that went all along the ridge towards the Dashiell Canyon also. A lot of people down there or up there were pretty frightened, and some of their places did burn. But we watched a mama bear and a baby bear just truck all the way down the road. They didn't care to use the forest at all. You know, they just went down our twisty, windy road all the way down to the river. They didn't dare take a shortcut or anything. It was pretty amusing. So all the way down the road were these great mama bear, baby bear tracks. Pretty cute. Yeah.
What about connections to the community?
It all kind of originated from house building, because people needed help. And so the word would go out by CB, because nobody had phones. We all had CB handles. And we would talk to each other in the evening when all the work was done for the day. And then if somebody needed a hand with whatever they were building, the word would go out, you know, we need some help with standing up a big wall, or we need some help with loading the rafters on the roof. And so that was a great way to meet and get the community tighter. And we would organize potlucks at times. And we also played volleyball pretty regularly. And that was up on Mid Mountain on this place called Apache Flats. And I was a little late for the naked volleyball sessions. Didn't happen after I moved up here with Will, but I hear there were naked volleyball sessions as well as clothed volleyball sessions. So that was another way to get together. There was a woman named Dana Crum that is pretty famous, who hosted Mother's Day banquets and potlucks, and that would draw, you know, over 100 people, you know, and as those families had kids, it would draw over 200 people, you know, but everybody brought food. She made amazing food. And there was, you know, this huge tradition on Mother's Day at her house.
What kind of food were you likely to find at a potluck?
It kind of grew with the years. Okay, early on, salads. Not too many sweets, unless it was blackberry season. And then people made blackberry pies or tarts or something. Fresh baked bread was very big. Some people had solar ovens and made solar oven fresh baked bread. Some people even ground their own flour to make bread. Sometimes fish from the coast, if people went over and got fish off of the fishing boats, we would have fresh fish. I'm thinking back, it was a long time ago. What was common? Probably food for protein, whatever was cheap. So it wasn't steak or too much red meat, chicken and tofu for the vegetarian people, which was also very common. Tempeh, which I never liked very much.
What about interactions with the people who were already here? Were they kind of standoffish or hostile or accepting? How did that go?
Well, I heard at first that people were a little hostile towards these hippies that were coming up here, you know. And I didn't encounter that myself, but I was kind of clueless too. Like, for example, going to town was a big event. You made a list all week long, and you proceeded from one end of town to the other, and if you had to double back, that was a big sin in one of my friends' eyes. You just kind of went down your list and proceeded from north to south or south to north. Well, one day in the middle of the summer, you know, it was probably a 100-degree day because it was Ukiah, I thought it was appropriate to go to town in my bikini. you know, and it just didn't even occur to me, because that's what how we were living out there. People were wearing nothing, or wearing a bikini, or wearing this, you know, dinky shift kind of dress or whatever. So, you know, it was only when I was standing on the corner of Gobi and State Street, and somebody went by and just, I don't know, if I can't remember if they wolf whistled or just went, put on some clothes or whatever it was that they did, that I realized, oh, probably not a good idea to wear your bathing suit to town. So I'm surprised that I didn't encounter more hostility, but, you know, a perfect place to encounter the old timers was the Powder Valley general store. And I never felt hostile intent or hostile feelings from people that worked there. And they were the old timers, you know. What was funny is that I established this relationship, and it took me about 5 years to actually ask their name after saying, hi, how are you? Hi, oh, nice to see you. You know, I finally said, we've been doing this for a long time and I'm embarrassed, but I need to ask what your name is. So, yeah, hostility. I think there was bitterness that for the people who had lived here a long time, that that we had the ability to build pretty much whatever we wanted. And there was a lot of trouble about that, a lot of difficult years with the building department. But we had the ability to go out there, build something inexpensively, and have a roof over our heads. And that wasn't necessarily the way their lives proceeded. You know, they had to do things a lot more officially, in terms of getting bank loans and things like that. You know, for many of them, they had homes that were family homes from way back. So that was, that's what happens when you're established in an area. But that and the pot thing, of course, that made it hard for people who didn't approve of that at all. Yeah, that was the thing that made it pretty hard for the two cultures to kind of mix. But eventually people started having kids. Those kids started going to school. Those kids wanted to play soccer or baseball, or they did after school activities. So you had a chance to hang out with parents of kids that weren't from homes that were going from people that were back in the hills. And that's when you had a chance to get to know somebody on a different basis, instead of like, oh yeah, you're one of those hippies on the hills. You became, oh, you're Sarah's mother, or you're Susie's mother. Oh, and then you could talk about your kids. So that made a big difference, having the kids.
Can you talk about the ways that Back to the Landers raised their kids differently from the way that you had been raised, or the way that people were being raised here already?
Well, they were naked. Those kids didn't put on clothes unless it got pretty darn cold. And I didn't grow up that way. At least I don't think I did. You know, and most of them were breastfed, because there was, along with the Back to the Land movement, it was Back to the Natural Birth movement, and getting midwives and not having to go to the hospital. Yeah, so the little kids were always naked. They groveled around in the dirt without people freaking out. If they were in the home, they were probably just on a plywood floor, not a carpet. People were very fond of the Waldorf school and the Waldorf method, and not having a traditional education. They were also very fond of homeschooling. A lot of people did that, some more successfully than others. But the main differences, I would say, would be they didn't have as many playmates, too. So there was more of a focus on entertaining yourself. There wasn't any internet. Nobody had TV. Most people didn't even have a radio. They just had a CB. So if you were going to entertain yourself, you were going to go out there and look at bugs crawling around, or look, Mom, there's a snake. But you learned pretty fast, you know, what was an okay snake and what wasn't an okay snake. Or, you know, I'm just going to go sit over there by that stump and make a little house, you know, those kind of things. So, yeah, but the clothes-free existence, that was pretty big. And also, most of the kids that I knew did not have disposable diapers. All the moms had cloth diapers, and they washed them off on a rock somewhere near the house, and then either, you know, took them into town to wash at the laundromat, or if they were already set up with a washing machine, washed them at home.
So what's an especially emblematic memory of the era for you?
This one doesn't fit with the classic vision, but it was probably one of my best memories. Somebody designed a Halloween party where we all would come as each other. And we put all the names in a hat, and you drew out a name, and you were that person. And you came dressed as that person, and you behaved like that person for the night. And somehow most of us arrived at about the same time, so there was this peals of laughter just coming from wherever people were parking their cars to where they were walking towards the house to when people came into the house, and guests were already watching people coming in the door. I mean, one person came with a canoe attached to them to represent Bob Cummings, the canoe builder, boat builder, you know, front and back. And this person was in the middle. The canoe was made out of cardboard, so it was lighter weight, but, you know, paddling their way into the door. So it was just a hilarious evening with all these personalities being lampooned by people who knew them very well. And I think only one person got very upset, and it wasn't very upset, but they were a little taken aback.
Who was you? How did that person represent you?
Jackie Keller was me, and she goes by Jackie Lowlich now. And she wore a tulle belt, and she wore a straw hat, because I always had a straw hat on in the summertime then, and I think she had on blue jeans, and she put her hair in a ponytail. Yeah, so that was not too hard to figure out.
Who are you?
I was Bill Fassett's dad, and he had moved up and been in the neighborhood for probably 5 or 6 years. So he was this delightful person who loved to play piano. So I got some white fuzzy hair, and let's see, I put on some sideburns, and I made my hair powdery white and pulled. I don't know how I did the hair to look more like his, but I found a suit coat, because he liked to dress with bolo ties and a Western belt and like cowboy boot kind of shoes and just nice trousers. So that was, you know, that was a Goodwill trip for me. I went and got a suit coat. I got a nice shirt. I put on the bolo tie and the trousers and the nice boots. And I was Bill Fassett Sr. Yeah. Great guy. Yeah. I think I was the only one who had to dress as somebody who was definitely a senior citizen, because we were all in our late 20s, early 30s.
Was there a downside to the experience for you of being a Back to the Lander?
The loss of my husband, yeah. And that didn't really necessarily have anything to do with being a Back to the Lander, other than I think it's kind of easy as a Back to the Lander to let things like alcoholism or drug addiction be hidden. You know, you don't have to come out until you're going to town for the big grocery run or the materials for a building. So, and you can even choose not to be social and hide out in the woods. Will was an enormously social guy. He was the life of the party, so that didn't apply to him. But I think it would have happened whether we lived in the city or the country, so that wasn't necessarily tied to being a Back to the Lander as a negative experience. If I can think of anything negative about being Back to the Land, I'd say it was kind of removing yourself from the larger community for a while, for some time. So many of us grew pot, and that was frowned down upon, and it's legal now, so things are changing that way. But the fact that you did that, and that was a source of some income too for a lot of people, or maybe exclusively for some people, kind of removed you from greater community. You weren't participating in election issues because you probably weren't voting. No. So there were a lot of things that removed people from the wider community, and I thought that was kind of unfortunate. That part was maybe what I would say would be the downfall to being a Back to the Lander.
So how do you think that having been a Back to the Lander has affected your life now that you live in Ukiah and are not homesteading anymore?
I think it's made it harder for me to dress appropriately. you know, between being a carpenter and being a Back to the Lander, where you don't get dressed up very often, or put on makeup or brush your hair nicely, or, you know, I think I got very relaxed in my standards about my appearance. So I'd say it kind of negatively impacted me that way. It is nice to look nice, and I do enjoy doing that, but I think my closet maintains a total focus on just really comfortable clothes and clothes that I don't care about getting dirty.
What about in terms of values that you learned and and experiences that you think are applicable to your life now.
Oh, okay. I learned that, you know, the freedom to be able to do that was just wonderful. You know, it was a dream to build my own house, to be able to actually buy property when it was affordable and build a house on it that was something you could live in was a dream. And how that affects me now is it motivates me to do something politically to help other people be able to do that. Because for people now, they become adults and they go, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to buy a house. It's just ridiculously expensive. So what can happen politically to make it possible for people to either join together to build a place to live or be able to acquire funds or, you know, have an automatic down payment that the government grants everybody so they can have their own house. You know, it just motivates me. I got lucky. There was still cheap land, and there's cheap land in Iowa and Kansas now, but, you know, a lot of people love California. We do, obviously. So that's how it changed me. I realized I was lucky. I was in a very lucky time frame about that. And I want to be able to carry that forward for people that are just now up and coming, thinking about a similar thing. I'm all about getting people involved in the trades. That's another thing that I'm really focused on and trying to help with. There's a lack of kind of focus or a lack of excitement, I guess, about not going to a four-year school and getting a degree and maybe taking up a trade instead. I don't think it's being talked about enough in life or in school or in any location or situation. So I think interesting people and getting them realizing that there is a way to make a great living doing that. You're not gonna be able to afford a house in San Francisco, but most people aren't anyways, no matter what their trade or their skill set. So yeah, I'm really trying to interest people in getting a continuing workforce going, be it electrical, plumbing, engineering, carpentry, roofing, you name it. Yeah, concrete work. Yeah.
How do you think that the Back to the Land movement affected the culture of Mendocino County as a whole, looking back on it now and still living here?
I think it led to a huge increase in creativity in this area. You know, I think you can be creative as a farmer and a rancher. There's a lot of things, a lot of problem solving you have to do. But in terms of the arts and craft, I think the ability of people to be able to be free to use their hands and express themselves in non-traditional ways really made a difference in this county. I mean, on any given weekend, there's at least 5 or 6 different things that are going on that you can pick from if you're bored and you want to do something that's fun. And they're all pretty creative, everything from space to what goes on at the college and the dance program to here at the Grace Hudson Museum, which already was going strong before the Back to the Land movement, so that doesn't really apply. But there's a lot of creativity that I think a good part of it came from people who moved back at that time or moved here at that time.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we wrap up?
I think we all owe a debt of gratitude to the folks that got Class K going. You know, that was quite an exciting time, quite a difficult time. There were people who were threatened with having their houses torn down. So the fact that somebody had the wherewithal to organize and approach the government about changing the Class K or changing the class codes in the building code really changed things. And it was something that's still working today for a lot of people, especially after these fires. They can do things a little less complicated if they use Class K, and it's not necessarily a bad thing to use Class K either. So I think that is pretty significant. It's statewide, too, so pretty significant.
We've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. I'm Sarah Reith. We just heard from Wendy Jackson. You can catch short excerpts during the news hour on Thursdays and longer episodes at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. They're also on our website and Facebook page with pictures and longer versions. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.